Can you hear me? Okay, good. Okay. Welcome back. So, my pleasure to introduce Jesper Jacobsen from ENS in Paris. He will talk about correction function with the critical model, local model.
Thank you very much, Denis. So my probabilistic path to probability theory goes via correlation functions in two-dimensional critical loop models. I'm going to present the work done with a number of collaborators that you will see on the screen. There are a few non-permanent people that I would like specifically to commend to your attention. Max Downing, who is my postdoc, soon moving to Trieste. Paul Roux, who is going to defend his thesis, also moving to Trieste after the summer. Ronko Ramnivas Vivat, who is at Abu Dhabi. And Linnea Grenz-Samuelsen, who is a postdoc in Oxford. The models that I'm interested in are lattice models. So they live on a hexagonal lattice like this. And what you do is you draw closed loops on that lattice. So loops cannot intersect, cross, or anything. And each loop has a statistical weight of n. They also come with a control parameter k that gives the weight per piece of step, which is adjusted in such a way that the model in the limit of a very large lattice or a very fine mesh is conformally invariant. So there are two possible values for this critical k. One is small, relatively small, and that's the dilute critical point. And one is larger, and it's the so-called dense critical point. And so whenever this loop weight is between minus two and two, those loop models have a conformally invariant continuum limit, although this has not been proved for more than sporadic values of n, but it's believed to be true. So in that continuum limit, they are characterized as a conformal field theory with a certain central charge. So the central charge is the master parameter of the conformal field theory that basically governs the whole content of critical exponents. And alternatively, it's possible to describe the same continuum limit starting directly from a probabilistic construction that's called the conformal loop ensemble. And it also comes with a parameter, it's called kappa, and that kappa is related to the central charge, and the central charge is related to n. So each of those three ways of looking at things, they have one continuous parameter. And there's a beautiful picture on the circle, or the sphere maybe, in which you see some nested loops, with the color showing the nesting level. So you can see that they are very complicated fractal objects. And our task is to compute correlation functions for those models. So there's some motivation coming from statistical physics. So in statistical physics, you would define this partition function, Z, where you sum, as I said, over the loops with those weights, k and n. And for specific values, you get very well-known problems. So for example, in the case n equals to one, where you don't even count how many loops you have, you will get side percolation in the dense phase, and you will get the easing model in the dilute phase. If you send n to zero, so that essentially you get one loop, you get a self-avoiding walk in the dilute phase. And if you take n equals to two, you get a Gaussian free field, also in physics called an XY model. And finally, if you I should have said n. I think n goes to zero in the last line. If you do that in the dense phase, you get something that is equivalent to a cube goes to zero state Potts model that gives you uniform spanning trees or forest via correlation functions. So all those conformal field theories, they are actually really logarithmic conformal field theories, but this aspect can be attenuated a bit by taking the value of n to be generic, so that we try to avoid actually taking straight away these integer values of n. But we take sort of you should imagine that n is some generic parameter living in this critical range. So the conformal field theory underlying this model has been elucidated a long time ago at the level of the central charge and the critical exponents. So if you parameterize your loop weight in this way with n, with a parameter beta, then you are going to get the central charge 13 minus what's written there. And then you will get various kinds of critical exponents that I list here. So there are it's important for to follow the talk to learn these three notations here. So the first one with a G, that was called a degenerate field. You should think of it as the energy operator in this model, the operator that finds out if there's a monomer somewhere, and its generalizations. So that's the 1-3 field, and there are 1, odd fields in general. So they have a singular vector at level S. So they are the kind of fields that you see in conventional conformal field theory. But the other two kinds of fields, those are the real motivation for studying this model further. So there's a field called a diagonal field. It comes with a general complex parameter. It's a spinless field. It has the same right and left moving conformal dimensions. And the last one is non-diagonal, so it has different left and right moving parts. And it has the strange property that these indices R and S, that are usually thought of as Katz labels, and in conventional conformal field theory, they are integers. Well, they are not really integers here. R is half an integer, and S can be a more complicated fraction, just so that R times S is an integer. R times S is the spin of this non-diagonal field. So now here is a bit more about this interpretation. So as I said, we have this energy operator. The role of the diagonal operator is that if you insert it in some point, you're going to modify the weight of any loops that encircles this insertion point. So it's going to be modified to a weight that depends on this parameter p, that was in general a complex number, or if you prefer, you can just think of real values. And the last kind of field, the one that is called non-diagonal, it has this interpretation that it inserts two R open paths in the model, and S determines a certain phase factor whenever some of these paths try to turn around their insertion point. So in the physics literature, they are called watermelon operators, because if you draw two of them next to each other, then the propagating lines, they look like the kind of design of a watermelon. Yeah, so the reason that R times S should be an integer, that's for single-valuedness of correlation functions. Also, the sum of the R labels should be an integer, because otherwise you cannot match up these inserted open curves. There is some handshake that are going on here. So the game here, the name of the game is to compute correlation functions. So for example, here on this slide, there is a configuration of site percolation. So you take hexagons and you color them black or white by flipping a coin. And the loops then emerge as the contours that separate black and white. And the kind of question that you might want to ask, and which has not been solved until quite recently, is, for example, what's the probability that given 3 points, say, for example, those three green points, what's the probability that those three green points belong to one same loop? So what happens locally in those points is that they each inject two open paths. And the only way that two open paths coming out of each of 3 points can join up without immediately self-contracting, which will give zero by the definition of those non-diagonal operators, is that actually all those 3 points will then belong to one same loop. And that the probability for that happening by a global conformal invariance has this dependence here on coordinates. I should mention here that when I use coordinates, you should think of them as complex numbers. So the two-dimensional space here is parameterized by complex coordinates, real and imaginary parts of those sets. And the behavior in those sets is completely fixed by global conformal invariance and the knowledge of this critical exponent, which is 1a. But the thing that was not known until recently is what constant should sit on top of this expression here. Now you might ask, so why don't I just normalize operators so that this constant is one? And the answer to that is that there are already two-point functions that have been normalized in this way, so you cannot normalize any further. So there's a non-trivial probability-related thing that is related to this numerator. So this particular question here was actually solved rigorously by Zai Wu in 24. And one of the results that I will present is to extend this to arbitrary values of these R and S. So I recall once again that non-diagonal field, they come with R and S parameters, where R can control the number of legs. So I can give you an infinite family of such things. But there is only one that has been proved by mathematicians. So where do those critical exponents come from? Well, they come from this old work, which is almost 40 years old. What you do is you take a torus, and then you try to compute the modular invariant partition function on the torus. So this was done by Di Francesco, Salvin, and Joubert in 87. So on a torus, you have a modular parameter. Tau is the aspect ratio of the torus, then by I tau. And then what you find is that the partition function in the continuum limit, it's expanded in terms of these characters. Eta is the Dedekind eta function. So it sort of generates with multiplicities all the descendant fields that come from a given primary field. And you see here in the first term here, you have all these the degenerate fields that participate, and they all come with multiplicity one, which shows that they are normal fields, so the fields that one is used to in CFT. But the others, they come with some non-trivial multiplicities L, and that shows you that they are quite special fields which don't have the properties that you would usually expect if your take on conformal field theory goes via minimal models. They come with a character that's the chi here. And one thing that you can notice is that the first chi here, it has a subtraction. This is why it's degenerate fields. There's a singular vector at level S that's being subtracted. But here, there is no subtraction at all. So those fields are not degenerate. And that makes it considerably more complicated to evaluate their correlation functions, because the usual 1980s take on conformal field theories is that you should use this degeneracy to compute correlation functions by moving to differential equations. For specific values of R and S, when they are both integers, actually the character of non-diagonal fields is more complicated. It contains a rank 2 Jordan cell, so they are indecomposable characters. So even when the loop weight or the central charge or the kappa parameter takes generic values, there's actually still something not logarithmic in those CFTs. The multiplicities, they can be written in this outlandish way here, also write them as Ramanujan sums. And it turns out that once everything has been done for any permissible R and S, they are polynomials in N via this complicated formula. Okay, now the LRS, actually, they are the smoking gun that there is something very interesting going on in this kind of model. Because if you look at, you do a more complicated computation than just the torus partition function. If you compute the twisted torus partition function, you will realize that the state of space of this model here has some bimodule structure, where on the right-hand side here, you have the thing that comes from conformal field theory. And on the left-hand side, you have something that reveals that the model has an ON global symmetry. And the role of this left-hand part here, this gamma, is that the dimension of this is LRS that you saw just before. So on the level of the state space, this is what it looks like before you just take dimensions. If you take dimensions, you get characters from the right-hand side, and you get multiplicities from the left-hand side, and then you are back to your torus partition.
Is that what is it, what you call a heuristic torus?
Well, so what you do is you sort of you take a group element of ON, and then when you compute your torus partition function, there's kind of a twist. When you go across the periodic boundary condition, you pick up some group element, and if you keep this group element generic, then you can get such an expression. So now you can take these representations and you can decompose them into ON. So those gammas, lambdas here, probably with Greek letters, lambdas, I guess. And what happens is that in the beginning, for the small representations, you just get one term. So for example, you see here that the thing that is supposed to just insert one piece of loop, that's the 1/2 0, that just comes with the representation one in Young tableau notation of ON. And this one comes with a symmetric and anti-symmetric representation on two boxes. But starting from three lines, things become more complicated because now you get sums of several representations. So you see, there's a general formula here. I just show the first few examples, but you see it gets worse and worse as you go along.
You get the same that is that irreducible repeated also, or is it?
Yeah. So for example, yeah, you see there's 2 2. For example, it comes in several places.
Yeah, but on the same line, do you get 2 2 twice or 3 times?
Yes, you can. Later, yeah, just if I had continued 2 more lines, you would see that they start coming with multiplicities, which are integers.
Are these lambda irreducible representations for a bigger algebra?
Sure.
Youngians or
okay, so the actual global symmetry is bigger than ON. And one thing that is complicated is that this bigger representation, this bigger symmetry, it does not come with a co-product structure, so it's difficult to somehow deal with it.
It's not a problem.
Okay, so now let's start our quest into correlation functions by looking at the geometry of a sphere or of the infinite plane. So two-point functions, they are given just by the conformal dimensions that you have seen and the field which is normalized. Three-point functions, I discussed a little bit. If you go to four-point functions, they will start depending on some cross ratio. And if we wanted to take four-point functions, say where there was a degenerate field entering in the correlation function, then we would find that they would obey differential equations of the BPZ type. And by that, we could solve for them. But those are not the cases that we're interested in. We're interested in the cases where there are no differential equations around. Nevertheless, this degenerate field still gives us some useful information because it gives us a so-called degenerate shift equation that I will discuss a little bit below. There exist other models in which there are degenerate fields not only of 1, S type, but also of R1 type. For example, in minimal models and in UVL field theory, that would be the case. And if you have those two types of shift equations, that would imply solvability. So those theories are easy, but this one is more complicated because you are somehow missing one shift equation. Therefore, we will need to do something more to find our correlation functions. We will need to constrain them by a principle that's called the conformal bootstrap. And the conformal bootstrap starts at 4-point correlation functions. And the idea is that you take your 4 points and you bring them together in pairs by two. And when you do that, you try to look at the short distance expansion. And you require that all three possible ways of bringing together the pairs in the pairs of point, that they will give you the analytic expression of the same thing. And that poses constraints that are called the bootstrap equations. However, unlike bootstrap results that you might have seen elsewhere, we can do a little bit better because it turns out that this degenerate field, the 1,3, it generates a so-called interchiral symmetry. So we are using this degenerate shift equation to simplify things. I will show you why. Also, the global ON symmetry turns out to be helpful. But as I already mentioned, the actual symmetry is actually larger than ON. And in the very end, that will turn out to be a crucial piece of information. Okay, so now still on this sphere, let's take four fields. Let's take their correlation function and let's bring them together two by two in what we would call the S channel. And then let's look at what we get. So we are going to get an expansion in terms of certain amplitudes, T's, and G's, which are products of left and right conformal blocks. The conformal blocks are known functions. They are determined by Samolodnikov's recursion relation, and they depend only on the central charge and on the dimension. But now the crucial role of this 1,3 field is that it determines actually ratios of the amplitudes d, where s has been shifted by 2 units. So that means that you can somehow you can sum up this expression here in such a way that you regroup everything that is shifted by units of 2. And then you will get this kind of expression here, where now the h's are interchiral conformal blocks, and s is now restricted to an interval of length 2. So that's very helpful. You can also produce the interchiral variants of those representations R and W that we saw just before. They will then acquire a tilde to show that they are interchiral. And then the idea, as I said, is that now you should bring together points in three different ways, and you should claim that all of this is the expansion of the same correlation function. So we know the spectrum of upscaling dimensions, and we can find help by studying the solutions in view of this ON symmetry. It's possible to constrain the solution space a bit by looking at something that's called a combinatorial map that will appear on the next slide. And in favorable cases, at least numerically, this will give us a unique solution, a solution that describes a correlation function, but it remains for me to say, what does this correlation function really mean? Okay, this will come in a short moment.
Sorry, when you write this clause, this relation between correlations, you know that they are well defined, or they
this
are
one.
No, it could be one of the previous slides. You connect relations.
Yes.
Therefore, you are already on the continuum, right? So you know that they are already defined in terms of volume and continuum or
Yes.
satisfaction. So they are already in the.
Yeah, so the conformal blocks, they are convergent in a certain
Don't
part
have
of
any
this.
symbolic. Should have symbolized in
Ah,
contact.
okay. Well, the correlation functions will not have singularities because the conformal blocks will behave, they will be combined in a very specific way that will turn out to be such that in the end there are no singularities in the correlation functions.
You don't disagree on.
No.
Yeah.
This you have to find by
We have to
computation.
check
Yes.
that. Oops.
And this it's very important because this determines the structure of it. Yes.
I thought you thought the
Yes.
what is presented here is probably for that other when this work follows for the natural example problem.
Okay, so this is those results describe what would be the continuum limit actually of any model of non-intersecting loops having this OM symmetry. So the specific lattice model on this hexagonal lattice, this will have this continuum limit. But if you wanted to start with a slightly different model on a square lattice or whatever lattice, you would get the same continuum limit. No. There's a lot of work for mathematicians to do if you really want to prove. I mean, for example, percolation, that's a case where things have been reasonably proved, okay? Well, have been proved. But as long as you take more general values of n, I don't think any of this is more than extremely well-established conjectures. So, but we have a whole collaboration for 5 years, so you can work. Okay, good. So let's get a little bit back to this lattice model here. So the lattice model comes also with a relation to diagram algebras, which gives another entry point in mathematics, but this time not in probability theory, but in algebra. So if you look at what it takes to move past a couple of vertices, you will see that all possible ways of covering two vertices, they are given by these eight diagrams. And what you should imagine is that if you take the product of this object R, first on all even sides and then on all odd sides, then you're going to construct your whole lattice models and you are going to construct all possible configurations of it. So this object, the linear operator that does that's called the transfer matrix. And it belongs to a certain cellular algebra that's called the unoriented Jones-Temple-Lieb algebra, some kind of variant of the usual Temple-Lieb algebra with periodic boundary conditions. And as anything in algebra, it acts on certain things. So it has representations which are standard modules. And those standard modules, they are so-called link patterns. They are pairwise connections between points with certain defects, and the defects they will sort of represent these legged operators that I showed you. And the magic thing that happens here is that those R and S labels that you saw first in the conformal field theory, they have a very precise definition also in the lattice model, so that you can consider it both ways. So it corresponds to two R defects as before and some momentum variable S. Whenever something spirals around your periodic boundary condition in the lattice model. So now the role of the ON symmetry here comes from the fact that ON has a commutant, which is the Brouwer algebra. The Brouwer algebra, that's what you would get if you pairwise connected things without regarding the constraint of non-self intersections. And so when you sort of use the branching rule to take the Brouwer algebra back to this Temple-Lieb algebra without the self intersections, then you will find that the state space will decompose in this way. And that looks extremely familiar because this is precisely the kind of decomposition that you already saw in the conformal limit, where now these representations over here, they are those standard modules. And these guys, lambda RS, they are exactly the same as before. So that means that the structure of the state space and the conformal limit is seen exactly at finite size for a cylinder of finite circumference L, L size. It's seen precisely, provided just that L is big enough that it can accommodate these two R defect lines. So it's completely stable with the size. And this is very fortunate because this is a crucial thing that will help us analyze this model. So the conjecture is now that the continuum limit, so to speak, the critical limit of this unoriented Jones-Temple-Lieb algebra, that's my conformal field theory, and the continuum limit of my standard module representation, that's those interchiral representations that you saw before, which is another thing that you might want to prove. Let's get back to correlation functions. Let's imagine I have 4 points. Let's imagine that I represent those 4 points just by small dots. And let's imagine that I look at a case where 1 point ejects 3 lines and the other points they take in 1 line. Then I claim that there is something called a combinatorial map that is in bijection with correlation functions. So the idea is that each point here that throws out legs, it comes with a cyclic order. And if you start turning around this point, for example, you turn around the first point and you would like to connect now things like this, this is the same combinatorial map. But if you start ruining the cyclic order, you will get a different combinatorial map. So this is one correlation function and this is a different correlation function. So in the case of 3 points, it turns out that whenever you take a choice of fields, you will just get one single combinatorial map. But as you saw here on the example, even if you take the same fields, say 3 legs, 1 leg, 1 leg, 1 leg, you can actually get different combinatorial maps for 4 points. So there are going to be more than one combinatorial map. So here are some examples with 3 points, 3, 3, 2 legs, 4, 1, 1 legs. You can also sometimes have 0 legs. Then you need those diagonal operators, the ones that were called BP. But in that case, you are not allowed to contract points that come out of one black dot if they don't do anything globally. So they have to move around, say, one of those points here. Otherwise, it's not a valid combinatorial map. So I have a much more formal definition of a combinatorial map, but I just wanted to give you first the idea. So now, let's now move to 4 points and let's do the bootstrap. So the idea was to bring together the points 2 by 2, as I said, and there's a useful characteristic that we shall need. Imagine that you draw some closed contour that will relate 2 points. So 2 points will be on the inside of this contour and the other 2 points on the outside. If you draw this contour in such a way that it intersects the least possible number of legs, then half of that number of legs, that's called the signature. And this signature is super useful for setting up the bootstrap because it's going to constrain the spectrum of the fields that can propagate between those two contractions of points. In fact, the R index that can propagate is bigger than or equal to this signature in the corresponding channel in all three channels. So here's another conjecture. The dimension of the bootstrap solution space is just the number of combinatorial maps. So this does not necessarily mean that if you give me a combinatorial map and if you give me some numerical bootstrap solution that I can find the correlation function that corresponds to that combinatorial map. Because if the solution space, for example, is sufficiently has a sufficiently high dimension and can be difficult to disentangle which one is which one. And I think there's a slide now that will illustrate this point. For example, take this case here with three legs, one leg, two legs, two legs. You can check that there are five different combinatorial maps. You can compute their signatures, and you can see that the third, fourth, and fifth, they are each distinguished by their signature. There's one C map for each signature, but the first two guys, unfortunately, they have the same signature. So that means that on the bootstrap side, you will just find a two-dimensional solution space, and it will be in general difficult to say which one corresponds to the first and which belongs to the second combinatorial map.
Sorry, I misunderstood. I thought the signature was just a single number.
It's a triple of numbers because there are three possible ways of contracting the points. Right.
So if you
contract this point with this point and then this point with this point, then you should look at this S channel, and then there's a T channel and a U channel for the other two ways of doing it. Okay. Now let's talk about magic. In general, in this problem, there are going to be different kinds of loops, which will all have, in general, different statistical weights. So for example, suppose that you use only diagonal fields, those fields that did not have any legs. Then you could have a loop that surrounds points or some other two points or some other two points. And those loops, I could give them weights W, S, T, and U for the S, T, and U channel. I could also have loops that surround just one point, and those loops, they could have weight 1, 2, 3, and 4, W1, 2, 3, and 4, and I call them external fields. If you had legs, then of course you would have only a subset of those possibilities, but in general, you should think that you can have WI fields, so for those external fields, and you can have WX fields with X equals S, T, or U for those channel fields. And the idea would be to compute the correlation function with all those different statistical weights in addition to the weight N of a trivial loop that doesn't surround anything. Now, we have observed that if you set up this problem here on a lattice of on a cylinder of circumference capital L, if you take the two pair of points to be separated by round L lattice spacings, if you use this parameter K, not necessarily the critical K for your monomer fugacity, and you use all those loop weights, well, the first thing I can say is that you can resolve that into the eigenvalues of the transfer matrix that I defined to the L power, and that comes with some amplitudes A. Now, on the next slide, the key observation is that if I take that eigenvalue amplitude, and if I take a ratio of it for different values of the channel field X, then it turns out that this is precisely the ratio between the four-point structure constants that appear in the continuum limit. So this is truly remarkable because on the left-hand side, you are on a lattice model, you are in finite size, and you're maybe not even at the critical point because you would find the same result for any value of K. On the right-hand side, you're in a conformal field theory. So somehow there is some information in this ratio that does not speak at all to the conformal field theory. It must speak to something else. And since I already showed you this bimodule decomposition, you will see what they should speak to is the global symmetry. So the message here is that you cannot expect to solve this kind of theory if you use only CFT techniques. You should also take into account this global symmetry, because otherwise there seems to be no room for understanding this kind of phenomenon. Now, what we have found on the CFT side is that if you divide the four-point function by a certain reference version of the four-point function, four-point structure constant that I will define shortly, then the result has this form here. Yeah? This part here that is actually some kind of answer to your question about analyticity, because there's a certain pole here that is adjusted in such a way that that you have a holomorphic dependence of the four-point function on its momentum variable. And this function here, f, is a known function, but the thing that is not known is the small d. So the conformal bootstrap cannot predict the small d, but it turns out to be a polynomial. And it turns out to be the same polynomial that you can get from this ratio here in the lattice model. The ratio in the lattice model is all of this, so you can isolate the small d. So the end game is to identify this small d if you want to have complete understanding of your correlation function. So first, the first thing we did was we used the numerical conformal bootstrap, and we were able to guess what those polynomials were here just by evaluating them in a certain number of points until we could understand that indeed it was a polynomial. But now, starting now, but not yet written up, we can do better because we can actually compute those small d systematically using ideas of lattice algebras of the temporally leap type. Now, in what follows, there's a special function that will appear all the time. It's called the Barnes double gamma function. It's defined by this horrible integral here, and it satisfies shift equations. So whenever the integral does not converge, you can just shift so that it will converge. And it turns out that if you thought that four-point structure constants would just factorize as a product of three-point structure constants, the object that can do that is the DREF. So that's a product of two normalization by two-point functions of two three-point structure constants. But this is, as we have seen, not really the four-point function, structure constant, excuse me, because it has to be multiplied again by this polynomial small d. But still, it singles out a particular role of these three-point structure constants c here. And okay, and this is known, so I will skip it. So this three-point structure constant here, we observe that if you insert the case 1 0 1 0 1 0, you get exactly the probability that three points belong to the same loop, the thing that was solved by our mathematician friends. And so what we will then do is that we will conjecture that this formula here actually gives the three-point structure constant for any combinatorial map. You just have to normalize things correctly by point functions so that you are independent of field normalizations. And then what you will get if you confront this with numerics is that basically for finite size, you get this cloud of points here. The redder it gets, the bigger it is. To extrapolate, you get those black points, and the analytic result is just it's spot on. And this we have verified for 15 or 20 different three-point correlation functions, so we are pretty confident that this conjecture is true, but it has not been proven yet. So this is your 27th task if you accept the assignment. Now let me move to a paper that will come out in 4 hours on archive. Well, I don't know what XXX is yet. We can also play this game here on a torus. On a torus, we look at one-point functions. So think of putting one point on a torus that spits out a certain number of legs. Legs are not allowed to contract unless they do something useful, which is to wrap around periodic directions. Then the sphere four-point function, it looks like this. The torus one-point function, it looks like this in bootstrap notation. And it turns out that parameters somehow are a little bit related. Some things get multiplied by two. The central charge is not the same here and here. But there is a relation between torus and sphere correlation functions that we can put to good use. But you see, what happens on this sphere, if you take three diagonal fields, is that the legged field that sits here on the corner, it can spit out a certain number of cycles that turn around each point. And on a torus, if you insert one point, what it can do is that it can insert a certain number of loop ends that will wind around one or the other or both periodic directions on the torus in this way. And there's sort of a correspondence between one and the other. But the thing that goes awry is that you are not allowed to have on the torus something that turns just around one point. So this has to be forbidden. So the way we deal with this is to take this this operator on the sphere such that the corresponding loop weight is zero. So in that way, we can make torus and sphere correlation functions coincide, and we can look at various kinds of combinatorial maps that correspond to throwing out legs, moving around certain periodic directions. And also for all of this, we can work out these reference pieces. And it turns out also that there are polynomials around, but the message is that those polynomials, we now know how to compute them because they come from diagram algebra. So we can actually figure out from the numerical bootstrap, the small g, but then in an analytic computation using lattice algebras, we can actually compute what those small g's are. And in those two lines here, which are not supposed to be really understandable, but which I bring up nevertheless, I tell you how to do it. Okay, so 4 points on a sphere, 1 point on a torus. Suppose we want to have boundary conditions. What could we do then? Well, there are two big families of boundary conditions in loop models, some that preserve the ON symmetry and some that break down ON symmetry to a subgroup. So for example, one kind of diagonal boundary condition that you can have is free boundary conditions. Loops just come to the boundary and then they reflect off it and they do nothing particular. But you can also project S strands that somehow come together on the boundary on a spin S half representation. And this is a more general construction, but that's still diagonal. If you want non-diagonal boundary conditions, you could modify the weight of loops that come close to the boundary, or you could do Dirichlet boundary conditions where open loop strands can come out of the boundary. What I want to focus on is the diagonal boundary conditions. And now I will move to a geometry that has a boundary that could be a disk or an upper half plane. You could conformally map between one and the other. So in the upper half plane, there are some very nice known results that are actual theorems. There is a crossing probability conjectured by Cardi, proved by Smirnov for percolation. The probability that a percolation cluster connects to disjoint boundary arcs. So that's a 4-point function of boundary fields. This is a super interesting and very nice correlation function, but it's not the one that we are interested in, because boundary fields, they are all degenerate. And so comes out satisfying differential equations. And this is not what we want here. We want something more complicated. There is a percolation formula by Schramm. It's also sometimes called the left passage probability. You take caudal SLE in the upper half plane. And the probability that caudal SLE goes to the left of a bulk point, that's a correlation function between one bulk field and two boundary fields, but those boundary fields are also degenerate. So also this satisfies a differential equation. And as a consequence, both of them are given by a hypergeometric function. What we want to do is to study 1 and 2 point functions of bulk fields that sit in the upper half plane. So they don't sit on the boundary. And in that case, we have no differential equations. Also, we don't get just one single conformal block, we get an infinite sum over conformal blocks, a bit like you have seen in this interchiral business. So here is what we can do about two-point functions on the upper half plane. So if we use complex coordinates, the coordinate dependence is completely known, but what is not known is this factor in G sitting up here, a non-trivial function of the cross ratio. So to find out what it is, we need to use the fourth boundary bootstrap equations. The boundary is this horizontal segment here. There are two ways of bringing together the points. Either you take the two bulk points together, and then you bring the result to the boundary, so that gives the bulk channel or S-channel expansion, or you take each of them to the boundary directly, then you get the T-channel or boundary channel expression. I have to check.
But it's a misprint. And if it's real, it's the one about zero.
I think it's all right. It's the distance to the boundary.
So now it was just asking. Yeah. Okay. So if it is real, it's zero, what? So if it's a meaning, so?
I get some pills. Thanks to me. So, one-point functions are non-zero only for diagonal or degenerate fields, and the boundary spectrum consists of diagonal fields because the boundary conditions are diagonal. And so what we can find is, for example, we can find the two-point connectivity. What's the probability that that those 2 points, they sit in the same FK cluster? That turns out to take the following structure for free and wired boundary conditions, the plus minus combination of these two Fs, and each of the Fs, that they are a sum of an infinite number of conformal blocks with some coefficients. And it checks excellently against numerics. And now I'm getting close to the end. So now the best game we can play now in this this context here is now to take two bulk fields such that we have four different types of loops that surround none of the points, they have a weight n, loops that write up one that run around one of the points has weight w1, the other point is w2 or w12 if they run around both of them. So that's the most general two-point function of diagonal operators. And it turns out in that case that all this conformal stuff, the reference pieces, that they can work out. And the only thing that remains unknown is that in the boundary channel, we still get those polynomials. Still another problem with polynomials. And if this gray box here is, that is a Jones-Mentel projector in the diagram algebra, it turns out that the polynomial is equal to this diagram. And this diagram can be evaluated by some recursion relation. So this problem actually, by putting together all those pieces, is completely solved. So once again, the take-home message here is that you cannot solve these problems just by doing CFT. You have to do CFT plus diagram algebras. If you don't put together those two pieces of information, I don't think you can really get there. So now I arrive at my conclusions. So we have analytic control, or we are very close to having analytic control of correlation functions of 3 and 4 points on the sphere or plane. 1 point functions on the torus, the annulus we can deal with, I think, but we need to work a bit more. And 1 and 2 point functions on the disk or the upper half plane. And the next few years, I'm planning to study operator product expansion in loop models. So you see here that the relation between 3 and 4 point structure constants were such that there was no factorization. So there is something strange going on the level of operator product expansions that needs to be figured out. In geometries with boundaries, I only talked about diagonal fields, but non-diagonal fields are also interesting. And my big dream is to do this kind of thing here on any Riemann surface for any kind of correlation function. And for that, what I would need to do is to develop some kind of Siegel-like approach that will work within the lattice algebra so that I can keep track of all this, of all these polynomials. And finally, since I basically characterized or self-characterized as a physicist, I would also like to find nice physics problems where all this approach here can be taken down to Earth and it will give some amazing, hopefully, predictions for some actual problems that could be related to physics. So thank you for your...
Thank you, Zepet. Any questions?
About the last comment,
is it
part of your presentation by probability theory related to loop flow?
Yes.
Do you see a path from your three dimensional by probability?
I live very well in two dimensions. you lose a lot of structure if you go to three dimensions. So there are other things you can do in three dimensions, which Slava is a big, big specialist in. But so you see, for example, all this, the extended symmetry of the lattice model, it came in particular from the fact that things were not allowed to cross. In three dimensions, you don't have such a principle, so this you are going to lose. Also, in two dimensions, we started right from slide number two, we started by knowing the spectrum of critical exponents. We know all critical exponents of those that enter those correlation functions here. Of course, she knows other critical exponents, but we don't study correlation functions based on that yet, but maybe that could be done. In three dimensions, you have only approximate, albeit very accurate, knowledge of critical exponents. So you cannot, like we do here, do those bootstrap computations by taking all conformal fields up to conformal weight 100 and compute everything with 2000 digits of numerical precision to be really sure about what we do. In three dimensions, things would be much more approximate. So I think, oh, sorry, what was the question?
But they will not, or I mean, they will form triangles. Of course, so that Gaussian path, just even though they're flying, it's in space, it's even the tension is going to be.
I was just explaining that in three dimensions, the topological things that loop and loop will ruin many of the things that we use in brain infection. So it's a much more complicated problem.
It's a bit of difficult to make difference. As Jesper is showing us, the more he looks at this, or she's convinced that all the models are basically exactly solid. For various approaches, very end of the solutions that.
Louder.
Yeah.
Should speak louder.
No, it's not.
Right. So the message is that in two dimensions, we believe that these models are exactly solvable and we are finding the exact solutions. So the, it seems that there is some hope that for any combinatorial map on any Riemann surface in two dimensions, you would someday be able to hand out an analytic result, maybe even backed up with rigorous proofs. Whereas in three dimensions, it looks it looks not as hopeful in three dimensions.
Okay. Yeah, question.
The easing correlations, they satisfy inequalities like the Griffiths inequality, like if you take a 4-point function, it's bounded below by the product of this two-point function of these 2 points, then this other one. Do you think one could examine if there are such correlation inequalities with your models? I mean, good enough description of the correlations to be able to examine these kind of inequalities.
I don't know those inequalities. So maybe it's a basic thing in your trade you should explain.
Olaf, you were mentioning about the arithmetic step. I haven't seen present something in your Gustav formula. We have got logarithmic term in the formula.
Yes.
So there are Jordan partners in the.
Yes, but it's not so severe that. Okay, so if R and S are both integers, then these two conformal blocks they combine and become a logarithmic conformal block. So there are actually things within this combined block here that depends logarithmically on coordinates.
You understand the state, which is Jordan partner.
Yes, yes. This is perfectly under control, and it's just rank 2. It does not get worse. So the reason that in the very beginning I kept telling you that I wanted to take generic parameter values of n is that I know that if I said, for example, n equals to 1 to get percolation, I know that there will be Jordan cells of arbitrarily high rank. Okay, so I think correlation functions still they can be handled by continuity, but inside there is a very complicated structure, and that structure can be used to produce logarithms in some cases, and this is highly non-trivial to study, but it's sort of also somewhere on the to-do list.
Okay, thank you.
Nice one for hopefully.